Well, I begin today with gratitude. I'm very grateful for the time I've had with you. I am especially grateful for the experience of the worship service this morning, the wonderful music, the multicultural, multiracial crowd. I think there's no better way to describe it. And Jackie's message and so forth. I told Jackie that, and John, that if I lived in New York City, there's a very good chance I would be part of this church. And that I would want my grandchildren to be part of this church as well. So, I think you know me well enough by now that I can begin the afternoon not only with something lighthearted, but with something that might be heard possibly as irreverent. I want to share with you a country western song, which may not be well known in New York City. I don't know. I learned about it in the mountains of North Carolina just over a year ago. I'm not going to sing it. You may be relieved. But I will share it with you. The name of the song is She Left Me for Jesus. And if you simply Google that, you'll get the lyrics, and you'll also get several YouTube performances. The singer and composer is named Hayes. That's his first name, H-A-Y-E-S. Carl is his last name, Carl with a C and with a double L at the end. So here we go. We've been dating since high school. We never once left this town. We used to go out on the weekends and we'd drink till we drowned. But now, she's acting funny and I don't understand. I think that she's found her some other man. Chorus. She left me for Jesus, and that just ain't fair. She says that he's perfect. How could I compare? She says I should find him, and I'll know peace at last. If I ever find Jesus, I'm kicking his ass. Next verse. She showed me a picture. All I could do was stare at that freak in his sandals with his long, pretty hair. They must think that I'm stupid or I don't have a clue. I'll bet he's a commie or even worse yet, a Jew. Chorus again. I won't do it. Next verse. She's given up whiskey and taken up wine. While she prays for his troubles, she's forgot about mine. I'm a-gonna get even. I can't handle the shame. Why, last time we made love, she even called out his name. One more time, the chorus. She left me for Jesus, and that just ain't fair. She says that he's perfect. How could I compare? She says I should find him, and I'll know peace at last. If I ever find Jesus, I'm kicking his ass. Let me remind you that there is a handout for this lecture. It's near the very end of your conference packet, beyond the blue tab. And I'm not sure if there are extra handouts for those who may be attending as members of the congregation this afternoon. Does anybody know if there are extra handouts? Or maybe nobody needs one. Not sure. And last comment, I do need to leave for the airport pretty much immediately after this talk. I'll have time to bless a few holy articles. or have my picture taken or whatever, but I will need to disappear, kind of like Jesus on the Emmaus Road, not long after I'm done. So I make the transition to my talk this afternoon with two brief prayers. The first one is a prayer from the Jewish tradition. The second one from the Christian tradition. A Jewish prayer. Days pass and the years vanish, and we walk sightless among miracles. God, fill our eyes with seeing and our minds with knowing. Let there be moments when your presence, like lightning, illumines the darkness in which we walk. Help us to see wherever we gaze that the bush burns unconsumed. And we, clay touched by God, will exclaim in wonder, how filled with awe is this place, and we did not know it. Amen. And a prayer from St. Augustine, around 400. So we go back in time some 16 centuries to this prayer from an African bishop in the north of Africa. O God, from whom to be turned is to fall, to whom to be turned is to rise, and in whom to stand is to abide forever. Grant us in all our duties your help, in all our perplexities your guidance, in all our dangers, your protection, and in all our sorrows, your peace. Amen. So I turn to this afternoon's topic, Jesus in Christian, Jewish, and Muslim perspectives. And I begin with an important qualification, or absence of qualification, if you will. I am an insider on Christian perspectives on Jesus and an outsider on Jewish and Muslim perspectives. I know a lot about the former and a little about the latter. And so I turn to part one, concise comments about Jesus in the three traditions. To begin with Jesus within Christianity, I say the obvious. He's utterly central. He is, to use language I used yesterday, he is for Christians the decisive revelation of God, of what can be seen of God's character, that is, what God is like, and God's passion, what God is passionate about, in a human life. That is the central meaning of incarnation. That Jesus embodies, incarnates the character and passion of God. That is what it means to affirm that he is the Word become flesh, the light of the world, the Son of God who reveals God, or, as I put it yesterday, the norm of the Bible, the standard for Christians by which the rest of the Bible is to be discerned and judged. And of course, within a few centuries of his historical life, he became the second person of the Trinity. And we should see that development as a testimony to the significance that he had come to have in the lives of his followers in the decades and first few centuries after his death. Indeed, Jesus and his significance are the reason for adding a third. A little aside here. Before Jesus, Jews could speak of both the transcendence of God, the moreness of God, and the everywhere presentness of God, the immanence of God. So within Judaism, even though it's radically monotheistic, there is a twofoldness to God. God is everywhere, God is more. Christians add a third. Why? Again, as a testimony to the significance of Jesus. I turn briefly to Jesus within Judaism. Within Judaism, he has a very ambiguous and, for many Jews, largely negative status. For an obvious reason, because of centuries of Christian persecution of Jews. I wish every Christian knew James Carroll's book, Constantine's Sword, which is an utterly devastating and sobering history of Christian persecution of the Jewish people, not just the famous events that we all know of, but beginning in the 4th century. And so Jesus is not only a negative figure, but often associated with brutality and terror. To be colloquial, for many Jews, Jesus is basically a dirty name, a five-letter word, if you will, okay? But with some of the associations of a four-letter word. There are some exceptions within the Jewish tradition. Two of the best known are Martin Buber and Albert Einstein. Martin Buber is probably the best known Jewish religious thinker among Christians of the 20th century. Abraham Heschel would be a close second. And Buber, and he's best known for his book, I and Thou, of course. But in a book he wrote in 1950 called Two Types of Faith, he said the following about Jesus. It's on your handout, quote, "From my youth onwards, I have found in Jesus my great brother. That Christianity has regarded and does regard him as God and Savior has always appeared to me a fact of the highest importance, which, for his sake and my own, I must endeavor to understand. I am more than ever certain that a great place belongs to him in Israel's history of faith, and that this place cannot be described by any of the usual categories." End of quote. And then from Albert Einstein in 1929, so he was 50 at this point, quote, "As a child, I received instruction both in the Bible and in the Talmud. I am a Jew, but I am enthralled by the luminous figure of the Nazarene. No one can read the Gospels without feeling the actual presence of Jesus. His personality pulsates in every word. No myth is filled with such life. Jesus is too colossal for the pen of phrase mongers, however artful. No man can dispose of Christianity with a bon mot, with a well-said expression." I turn to Jesus within Islam again very briefly. Revered, a much more positive image than we find amongst most Jews, revered, but not with the same status as he has for Christians, of course. The Quran affirms that he was born of a virgin. Indeed, there are more verses about Jesus' mother Mary in the Quran than there are in the New Testament. It also affirms that Jesus performed miracles, and it affirms that Jesus was the Messiah, though not with the meaning Christians give to that word. Indeed, for Muslims, Jesus was not only a prophet, but the greatest of the prophets until Muhammad. But not the Son of God. And he did not die as a sacrifice for the sins of the world. Indeed, within the Muslim tradition, he didn't die at all. But he was removed from the cross, and somebody who looked like him died in his place. The understanding being that God does not kill God's prophets. And, but nevertheless, as I've already said, he is second only to Muhammad in importance. Final comment in this first section. The theological problem for Jews and Muslims is what Christians call the divinity of Jesus. For most Jews and Muslims, it sounds like a rejection of monotheism, that we Christians not only believe in God, but we have at least a second God, namely Jesus. And that's understandable because it's based on common ways that Christians speak about Jesus and what they believe or think they are supposed to believe about Jesus. Think of some of the phrases in the Nicene Creed from the 300s. Jesus is the only Son of God, begotten before all worlds, very God from very God, begotten, not made. And then there is the common, though mistaken, Christian belief that Jesus, as a historical figure, was both human and divine. Put simply, it's that question sometimes asked in quite crude form, do you believe Jesus was God? It's a trap question, of course. And for those who ask it, it's often a test of orthodoxy. By the way, the right answer is, it depends upon whether you're asking about the pre-Easter Jesus or the post-Easter Jesus. The pre-Easter Jesus, of course not. The post-Easter Jesus, of course yes. But anyway, let that go for now. Most people don't appreciate smart-ass answers like that. And then, of course, there's the language of the three persons of the Trinity. And that language itself makes it sound as if God is a committee of three, kind of three discrete personalities within one of those glowing nimbuses, or should it be nimbi, but you get the point. Now, there is a way of understanding the Trinity that eliminates this problem, or at least changes the framework of discussion, namely, the notion, that is, the concept, or if you wish, the doctrine of the Trinity, is a Christian way of preserving monotheism while also affirming that the one God is known in three primary ways, as the Creator and the God of the Law and the Prophets, the God of Israel. In Jesus, the Word become flesh, and in the continuing presence and activity of the Spirit. The ancient meaning of the word translated into English as person supports this meaning. The Latin term is persona, and you can see how we get the English word person from that. The Greek word is prosopon, had as one of its primary meanings the mask that actors wore in the Greek and Roman theaters. For those of you who know something about the psychology of Carl Jung, this, of course, is the meaning of the word persona in Jungian psychology. It's the face we present to the world. But back to the masks that actors wore in the theaters, they wore masks not for the sake of concealment, but in order to play different roles. Now, within this meaning of persona, the notion of one God in three persona affirms monotheism, one God, even as it also affirms three primary roles in which the one God is known. So God is not a committee of three, one God known in three primary ways. Within this framework, Jesus is for Christians the primary revealer of the one God, just as Moses is within Judaism and Muhammad is within Islam. That's a major similarity as well as a major difference. The difference is where or in whom does one find the primary revelation of the one God. But the Trinity need not be understood to mean three gods or a committee of three. With those comments made, I now do a jump shift, and then later I'll return to the theme of Judaism, Islam, and Christianity and their perspectives on Jesus. The jump shift is the perspective provided by mysticism. I began by acknowledging that the word mysticism and its siblings, mystic and mystical, are ambiguous terms in contemporary English. They often have negative and even dismissive associations today. When somebody says, "Sounds mystical to me," it is seldom a compliment. And especially amongst conservative Christians, at least half of American Christians, it also has negative associations. A quick example, an evangelical author, a fine evangelical author named Ken Wilson, in the news now because he's one of the few evangelicals who has come out in favor of full rights for gay and lesbian people. But about 5 years ago, he wrote a very fine book on prayer called Mystically Wired. And it combined contemporary neuroscience with the prayer traditions of the Christian church to argue that it seems that our brains are wired not only for prayer, but for the experience of the sacred. Most Christian bookstores would not carry the book because of the title, Mystically Wired. For many conservative Christians, mysticism is associated with the occult. And of course, in some ways, they're smart because, as I mentioned yesterday, a mystic, think of the story I told about Martin Luther, a mystic knows that no religious institution or no religion has a monopoly on God, and that's deeply threatening to conservative religionists, whether Christian or of another tradition. In the academic world, it's not so much that it has negative associations, but it is sometimes defined very narrowly or much more broadly. Its narrow definition makes it an esoteric phenomenon confined to particular times and places. For example, the narrow definition would argue there is no mysticism in the Jewish tradition until the Middle Ages. It would also argue there's no mysticism in the Christian tradition until the Middle Ages. Hence, it becomes a medieval phenomenon. And therefore not all that important. But it's also defined more broadly, and this is the definition I'll be using today. Its broader definition refers it to an experiential sense, an experiential awareness of the sacred or God or, to use William James's generic term, a more, a stupendous more. To use a Latin phrase from the Christian Middle Ages, and I use this both to show the antiquity of the notion as well as to make you feel like you're getting your registration money's worth. Mysticism is the cognitio experimentalis Dei, and you can virtually translate it into English without even knowing Latin. Cognitio, of course, is knowledge. We get cognition from that word. Experimentalis, experiential. Dei, God. Mysticism is the experiential knowledge of God or the sacred. For those who have mystical experiences, God or the sacred is not simply an article of belief, but an element of experience. Mystics are people who know God or who have had experiences that seem overwhelmingly to them to be experiences of the sacred. These experiences range from glimmerings to deeply ecstatic experiences. And they are memorable. You don't forget them. And if somebody says, well, I'm not sure whether I've had a mystical experience or not, it's a little bit like saying, I'm not sure whether I've ever had an orgasm. You know? You probably haven't. To develop this with William James's classic work, The Varieties of Religious Experience, now over a century old. By the way, back in 1999, when people were compiling lists of, you know, the 100 most popular songs of the 1900 of the last 100 years, or the 100 most important novels of the last 200 years, one of those lists was the 100 most influential books originally published in English in the previous century. Number two on that list was William James's Varieties of Religious Experience. And in that book, James has a fairly extended section on mysticism. And his definition, based upon not just theoretical considerations, but on interviews as well as reading accounts of mystical experiences and so forth. He was a psychologist as well as a philosopher. Based on his own study of these experiences, he came up with two defining characteristics or features. The first of these, and these are experiential again, a sense of union or connectedness with God, to use synonyms, the sacred, with what is. James, seeking a generic term for what is experienced, calls it a more or the more. These experiences involve a non-ordinary state of consciousness, an ecstatic state of consciousness. And here the Greek roots of the word ecstasy or ecstatic are helpful. Ecstasy, ecstatic, means to be out of one's ordinary way of being. So it's a state of consciousness beyond ordinary everyday consciousness. And again, at the risk of sounding jargony, but I have chosen these words very precisely, so they're meant to be clear. These experiences include a momentary disappearance of what is oftentimes called the self-world distinction, that world of ego separation of the boundary self. To explain, ordinary everyday consciousness, the consciousness you're in right now, unless you've dozed off or quite mysteriously are having a mystical experience at the moment, ordinary everyday consciousness is marked by the subject-object distinction. Something very simple is meant. I experience myself as a subject. I'm in here. You and the world are out there. I experience you as objects. no matter how kindly disposed toward you I might be, and no matter how much I realize that, of course, you are persons and not simply objects, still, I experience you as being out there, me as being in here. That's the world of the subject-object distinction. Even our grammar reflects it. I see you. This is the boundaried self. In mystical experiences, this sense of separation vanishes or becomes very soft. And I become much more aware, not just intellectually, but experientially, of my connectedness to everything that is. It's as if the dome of the ego, and by the dome of the ego, I mean that sense we all have of walking around inside a little bubble. Some of you are old enough to remember the Colgate toothpaste advertisement. An invisible guard-all shield protects you, and so forth. You know, it's like we walk around inside of this invisible guard-all shield. That's the boundaried self, once again, the dome of the ego in mystical experiences. That falls away, becomes soft, permeable. And again, to repeat myself, we experience our connectedness, our union with what is. One of the most common triggers for this kind of experience amongst contemporary Americans is music. Whether performance music or listening to music, some of you may have had that experience where suddenly it's not you listening to the music as something outside of you, but there's only the music. The second defining feature or characteristic of mystical experiences, according to James, is his language, a sense of illumination. Oftentimes, this involves an experience of light. Could be that the light changes, or everything becomes luminous, as if there is light shining through everything without everything becoming transparent. Or it can be a sense of not so much the light changing, but of enlightenment, of seeing anew, of having one's eyes opened. Think of that great line from Amazing Grace, "I once was blind, but now I see." The language of mysticism is full of images of light and seeing and knowing and the opposites of darkness, blindness, and not knowing. Mystics see differently. They see reality, the world, and their lives differently. At the risk of TMI, I'm learning how to tweet. OMG. Okay. And I've just joined FB. Okay. That's Facebook. Okay. 21st century guy. Anyway. At the risk of TMI, but for the sake of trying to characterize these experiences so that you'll have the best possible chance of glimpsing what I'm talking about. From scholarship since James, scholars have spoken of two primary kinds of mystical experiences, extrovertive and introvertive. Extrovertive mystical experiences, put in slightly different language but accurate language, are eyes open experiences. You see the same world you would otherwise see. The same room full of people, the same landscape, no angels or virgins dressed in blue, okay, no extra beings, but everything looks different. again, as if illuminated from the inside, or the light may become lemony or golden. Indeed, this is such a standard feature of these eyes open mystical experiences that Mircea Eliade, probably the best known historian of religions of the 20th century and therefore of all time, since they weren't really known before the 20th century, had a phrase to describe them. He spoke of these extroverted experiences as, quote, experiences of the golden world, of the world become golden. The world is seen to be full of the glory of God, to use a phrase from the prophet Isaiah. And in the Bible, the word glory very frequently means radiance, luminosity. To say the world is full of the glory of God is to say the world is full of the radiance of God, the luminosity of God. Only most often we do not see that. Introverted mystical experiences, put differently, are eyes closed mystical experiences. They include visions, like of saints or of Jesus or of Lord Krishna and so forth. They also can include auditions. An audition is, to say the obvious, an oracular form of a vision. You hear a voice. And sometimes they include a sense of the presence of the sacred in the silence of contemplative prayer. That internal silence in which we sometimes have a sense of descending to a deep level of our being, where we open out into that sea of being in which we live and move and have our being. Finally, back to James, four additional features. The first of these, ineffability. What James means by this is that the mystics regularly say that the experience cannot adequately be put into language. Mystics will say, it's really, really hard to describe what I experienced. It was like. Language can but stutter and stammer as it tries to speak of these experiences. A second additional feature, transiency or transitory. By this, James means they are brief, a few seconds, sometimes a few minutes, rarely a few hours. Passivity. When I first read this in James, I thought, well, what does this mean? And then I figured it out. Nothing terribly mysterious. James means by this that we receive these experiences. You cannot actively make them happen. You can't learn a formula, and if you follow the formula, then you'll have one of these. I recall having had one of these one day, and I tried to set up the exact same circumstances another day, the same music on the stereo, the same lotus position that I was sitting in, the same number of hours since I had eaten. Didn't work. They come upon you. That's what it means to say passivity. And finally, and very importantly, James reports that they are noetic, not a word we're accustomed to, perhaps. It means something very simple. People who have these experiences say they involve a knowing and not simply an ecstatic feeling or an altered state of consciousness. There is a strong sense of knowing something you didn't know before. And what you know is the way things are. Not as an atomic scientist might describe the way things are, but there is a sense of having seen more clearly and truly than you ever have in your life. Now, to move beyond James, though James talks about this too, to the next point on the handout, namely the transformational effects of these experiences. People who have vivid and or frequent mystical experiences are radically changed by them, transformed by them. Some of you may have read some books about near-death experiences. By the way, they are of very uneven quality. Some I am very skeptical of, but there's been enough serious research in that area that I take it for granted that these experiences really happen, that people sometimes, as they near death, have an experience of traveling through a tunnel, seeing a great light, sometimes hearing beautiful music, sometimes seeing magnificent landscapes, and so forth, as if they have entered into another world. And people who have these experiences and come back, and of course everybody who has a near-death experience has come back, you know, they consistently say that the experience has radically changed their attitude towards life. They consistently report that there's far less anxiety in their life. And that's because they have a vivid sense of reality being more than what they thought it was. They see differently. They know differently. They not only often become free from anxiety, but for the same reason become filled with a kind of courage. And anxiety about death virtually disappears. Now, to connect this back to Jewish, Muslim, and Christian traditions, the foundational figures of these three traditions, and I would argue of Buddhism as well, and indeed of Hinduism, even though we don't have a founding figure with Hinduism, but the ancient Vedas are pervasively mystical texts. But let me stick with Jewish, Christian, and Muslim traditions here. The foundational figures of the three traditions are all portrayed as people who had experienced God, the sacred. Stories are told about all three of them that put them in the category, in the broad sense of the word, of mystics. To remind you, Moses, the central figure for Judaism, certainly not the author of the Torah, but of such towering significance for Judaism that the Torah is attributed to him. Think of the stories told about Moses, the story of Moses and the burning bush. Moses sees a bush that is full of light, that burns without being consumed. And out of that light-filled, radiant bush, he hears the voice of God. Then there are the stories of Moses ascending the sacred mountain, again and again, called Sinai at times, called Mount Horeb at other times. But in so many religious traditions, a mountain, especially the sacred mountain, is a symbol of what connects heaven and earth. It's the omphalos, the navel of the world, the connecting link. Moses ascends the sacred mountain again and again, And at least on one occasion, when he comes back down the mountain, his face is glowing so brightly that the Israelites cannot even look at him, and so he has to wear a veil. By the way, in that world, who wears veils? Women. Moses was a cross-dresser. Now, you know, and I hope that's not the only thing you remember from this afternoon. But the basic point is, these stories are told about Moses as one who experienced God and who was transfigured by it. And then there's his obituary at the end of the last chapter of the Pentateuch, Deuteronomy 34, where we are told not only that Moses lived to be 120 years old, but that he was one who knew God face to face and spoke with God mouth to mouth. Moses, using William James's criteria, was a mystic. And then Jesus. If you take seriously that people have visions, if you take seriously that people have experiences that seem overwhelmingly to them to be experiences of the sacred, then clearly Jesus was a Jewish mystic. He has visions. According to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, at his baptism, he sees the heavens opened and the Spirit descending upon him in the form of a dove. According to Mark, by the way, that's a private experience. Matthew and Luke both objectify it as if the crowd also sees it. But for Mark, the earliest report of that story, it's a private visionary experience. There's no suggestion that John the Baptizer sees anything special going on. And so Jesus' public activity, according to Mark, begins with an experience of the Spirit of God. And that is followed, of course, by what we call the temptation narrative. But an anthropologist recognizes that story immediately as a classic vision quest, going out into the wilderness and fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. In many traditions, that is a spiritual practice, and prolonged fasting, we know, does produce an altered state of consciousness. The metabolism actually changes and so forth. The digestive system shuts down. By the way, basketball players who have tried fasting report after 4 or 5 days, they are remarkably good at shooting free throws. You know, it's almost as if they can guide the ball into the hoop. Of course, they got no energy for going up and down the court, so it's not really a good strategy. Nevertheless, fasting, serious fasting, don't do this without supervision, by the way, produces an altered state of consciousness. And then, of course, there are passages like where Jesus is said to have said about himself, "The Spirit of the Lord has anointed me." Jesus speaks of himself as a Spirit-anointed person. And it's very easy to imagine that his followers sometimes experienced a sense of the Spirit around him. Similar stories, by the way, are told about St. Francis, perhaps the greatest of the post-biblical mystics, that his followers sometimes sensed the presence of the sacred around Francis. And to jump to the Buddhist tradition, same thing about the Buddha. A Buddha field or a Buddha zone sometimes experienced around the Buddha, presence of the Spirit. And then Muhammad, of course, we're all familiar with his trance-like states that went on from time to time over a period of years. And in these trance-like states, mystical states, he hears auditions called recitations within the Muslim tradition. And this, it is said within Islam, is the source of the Quran, God's ultimate revelation within Islam. I turn to my concluding section, though it will take maybe 10 minutes, so not like a two-minute conclusion. An important realization for all of us, the traditions, now I could be talking about simply Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, but I think it also applies to Hinduism and Buddhism and the other enduring religions of the world as well. The traditions are closest in their mystical forms. I begin with a fairly common, even though not universal, scholarly distinction. The distinction is between the internal core of religions and the external forms of religions. Sometimes this is expressed with the same meaning in slightly different language. The esoteric core, that's the internal core, and the exoteric forms, that's the external forms. Internal and external are much simpler words. The claim, using this distinction, is that the religions, plural, are most similar in their internal core, that is, in the mystical experience that gives birth to them, and most different in their external forms, meaning the language in which these experiences are talked about, the practices of the different traditions, the rituals, the doctrines, and so forth. Now, mystics know that. Mystics not only have experienced the internal core, but they know the inadequacy and thus the relativity of all language, of all external forms. Recall James's claim that the experiences are ineffable. It means they are beyond all words. And what this means, should we say concretely or theologically? God is unnameable. And of course, virtually every tradition affirms this. You know, it's at the heart of Judaism. The sacred name of God may not be said aloud, may not be pronounced. And when Moses asks at the bush, "What is your name?" You all remember the answer, I think. It's kind of Popeye theology. I am who I am, you know. But I am. I am who I am. But the serious point, it's a tautology. A tautology is a sentence in which the second half says exactly the same thing as the first half and thus doesn't tell you anything. God's name is amness, if you will, but God's name may not be pronounced. It is so sacred. The sacred is unnameable, and yet for the same reason, multi-nameable. Within Islam, you have the 99 names of God, because no one name is adequate. Allah is the generic term, but then you have the 99 names of God. By the way, the most important of those 99 names is the compassionate one. Okay? Within Hinduism, you have 330 million gods. Now, I don't think they've ever named them all, but they're making the same point as Islam is making with the 99 names of God. No one name is adequate for the sacred because the sacred is beyond all names. And so to make that point, you say there are 330 million ways of naming God. By the way, back to the handout, the opposite alternative to the recognition that all language for the sacred and that all external forms are relative and so forth. The opposite alternative is to absolutize the language and the particulars of the tradition. And whenever the particulars of a tradition's language are absolutized, the effect is that the differences between the traditions are emphasized and conflict is most often the result. You know, I don't want to... Well, I'm a Christian. I can take a jab at the Christian tradition, okay? You know, that fairly common Christian understanding, especially amongst our conservative brothers and sisters, that Jesus is the only way of salvation. It's almost salvation by syllables, that you've got to have the right language. It's a classic example of what happens when the particulars of a tradition are emphasized. And so if you don't know Christian language, if you don't have the word Jesus and so forth, you can't be saved. That's just an example of what happens when the language of a tradition becomes absolutized. Back to the handout. There is a shared core value in the mystical streams of the tradition. And this shared core value, you might call it the universal ethical value, is compassion. I've already mentioned briefly that the compassionate one is the most important name of God within the Muslim tradition. Yesterday I mentioned that compassion is what a mother feels for the children of her womb in terms of the linguistic associations of the biblical word. For those of you, and thus compassion is utterly central for both Judaism and Christianity. And many of you are aware that compassion is the core value of the Buddhist tradition and so forth. And this is why Karen Armstrong, when she created her foundation for inter-religious dialogue, called it the Charter for Compassion. That strong sense that compassion is the core value that flows out of the internal core of the enduring religions of the world. And I note briefly in passing that compassion involves both seeing, feeling, and acting. Compassion as seeing flows out of realizing that the whole of creation is the work of God, or to use a metaphor from the Jewish tradition. There is a saying from the post-biblical Jewish tradition that in front of every person marches an angel proclaiming, "Behold the image of God," that every person is the image of God. If you see that, that's the beginning of compassion. But of course, compassion is also a feeling. And sometimes we turn away from compassion because the feeling is too painful. when we become aware of what sometimes happens to the creation of God and the creatures of God. And then finally, compassion is also more than a feeling. It's acting in accord with that feeling. When Jesus sums up theology and ethics in 6 words in English, he says, "Be compassionate as God is compassionate." Compassion is the central quality of God. Therefore, a life centered in God will be filled with compassion. By the way, he says, be compassionate, not simply feel compassion. To be compassionate is to act compassionately. I move to my conclusion with a concluding image or analogy. The image is of the mountain and the paths. And I owe this image to a scholar named Marco Pallas. I believe he's British, a book written in the early 1960s, but out of print, so I can't tell you more about his book. But I found the reference in a book by the marvelous contemporary Muslim scholar Saeed Hossein Nas, and he appreciatively cites Pallas's image of the mountain and the paths. The world's religions, meaning the enduring religions of the world, the ones that have stood the test of time, the world's religions are like different paths spiraling up the same mountain. Visualize the image now. At the bottom of the mountain, the paths are farthest apart from each other. So far apart that the followers of these paths may not even be aware of the existence of other paths and other people walking those paths. And that may sound foreign to us in a world that has become globally interlinked and all of that, but consider how recent the conscious awareness of other religious traditions is. Most European scholars prior to 1800, European scholars now, the intellectuals, had no serious awareness of Buddhism or Hinduism, or for that matter of Native American traditions, because they would be stereotyped or whatever. And most people growing up in villages in Europe until 100 years ago, would have had no personal awareness of people from other traditions, unless there was a Jewish ghetto in a city. And then, of course, the awareness would be exceedingly limited or stereotyped. Back to the handout. So, near the bottom of the mountain, not only are the paths the furthest apart, but people might not even know about people on the other paths. But as the paths ascend the mountain, the paths grow closer together until at the top they converge and then disappear. Now, do not confuse this image with all religions lead to heaven. That's not the goal of all religions, and it's a peculiarly Western notion based upon Christianity for the last 1,000 years or so having been primarily a religion of the afterlife. Classic example, as recently as 5 years ago, in a national Gallup poll in the United States, the question was, do you think more than one religion leads to salvation? And then the poll explained the question. That is, Do you think more than one religion leads to heaven? The poll itself equated the goal of religion, salvation, with going to heaven. So don't think of this, oh, I guess all religions lead to heaven, la-di-da-di-da. No, the point is, and I'm back on the handout now, this image of the mountain and the paths is an affirmation that the internal core and purpose of the enduring religions of the world are remarkably similar. The religions of the world, are means, practical means of ultimate transformation. A transformation of the self at its deepest level that is more than psychological, even though it will have psychological effects as well. That is the purpose of the paths, and the internal core, the experience of the sacred, is the unifying element, not only within Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also among the great religions of the world. Thank you.